argument this morning is Young against Holder. Mr. Shaw.
May it please the Court. My name is Tejas Shaw, and I'm here on behalf of Ms. Thoma Luella Young. The issue before the Court concerns the procedural safeguards which are afforded to Ms. Young in removal proceedings. Ms. Young, the mother of 5 United States children and 10 grandmother to 10 United States citizens, was placed in removal proceedings after an application for adjustment of status was filed for her through her daughter. The government alleged that she attempted to enter the United States in 1974, and in doing so, falsely claimed that she was a United States citizen. During a lengthy series of hearings in the immigration court in Chicago, the government submitted numerous documents that were unauthenticated, as well as submitting documents at a final hearing in support of its allegation to prove the truth of the matter asserted, which was that Ms. Young attempted to enter the United States in 1974 and falsely claimed United States citizenship while doing so. The immigration judge's admission...
I'm puzzled by this. Are you arguing that any statute or rule was violated by this procedure? The federal rules of evidence, of course, don't apply in these hearings.
In fact, I am, Judge. While we recognize that the federal rules of evidence do not strictly apply to immigration court proceedings...
They just don't apply. Right? There may be rules of evidence established by the agency. Were any of them violated?
Well, certainly there are procedural rules through the statute, the Immigration and Nationality Act, as well as the Code of Federal Regulations. Specifically, I would direct you to 8 U.S.C. Section 1229.
It's 1229A, but my question is concrete. I mean, you cite in your reply brief 1229A, but what concretely in that statute did the agency violate or offend?
There are two sections of that particular statute that were violated, Judge. It was Ms. Young's right to present evidence, as well as her right to examine the evidence presented against her. And so if we look at the fact that evidence was submitted at that final hearing, Exhibits 10 through 13, that Ms. Young had no opportunity to review in advance, that clearly is a violation of that statutory guarantee.
Now I'm completely lost. The right to deal with evidence at a hearing differs from discovery. If what you're saying is that there was a violation of discovery rules, and discovery means disclosure in advance, right? If you're saying there was a violation of discovery rules, then what you need to do is say, well, here was the discovery order. It required the disclosure of document X, and document X wasn't disclosed in compliance with that order. Are you making such an argument?
Well, Judge, simply because of the fact that we don't have the same sort of discovery rules applicable.
No, we don't have the same discovery rules, but you can ask an immigration judge to order the government to turn over certain documents, and if he does, then the agency has to comply. I'm just asking, trying to be concrete. Did the immigration judge issue such an order that was not complied with?
There was no such order issued, Judge, but that was simply because Ms. Young had no notice that these documents even existed.
No. You don't ask for discovery on the day of the hearing or later. You ask for discovery before the hearing. Right? That's the whole idea of discovery. You say, tell the other side to turn over the documents it's going to rely on at the hearing. But I gather you didn't ask for that.
Well, certainly, Judge, if Ms. Young had had some indication that these specific documents or that there were other documents relevant to the same issue.
Assume this is a normal civil trial being tried in U.S. District Court. We don't have a system in which, long before the trial, one side identifies the documents on which it relies, and only then does discovery begin. You get requests for production and requests for admission. And one standard request will be, disclose to us the documents you want to introduce in evidence at trial. And then they'll be in the pretrial order. But all of that is done because the parties do it before trial. You don't get to trial and only then say, now we want discovery. Right? So let me ask again, did you make those standard kind of requests before the hearing?
Well, Judge, it was the government's burden to establish certain points, and they were, in fact, required to submit certain documents.
It is fine to say we're going to trial and the government's got to prove its case, but that's not a discovery argument. That's a question about the sufficiency of the evidence.
Well, essentially, we're not advancing a discovery argument, Judge. We're advancing an argument about the sufficiency of these proceedings. I certainly understand your question. And if this were, in fact, a trial that were governed by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and strictly by the Federal Rules of Evidence, it certainly would be relevant. But as you yourself recognize, Judge, this is not a proceeding in which the Federal Rules of Evidence are strictly applicable. However, this Court has previously recognized that they do apply in spirit and quite frequently has recognized that. In keeping with...
I don't even understand what that could mean.
Well, essentially...
We have quite a few agencies. They all have distinct discovery rules. The discovery rule for what happens at the NLRB differs from the discovery rule for what happens at the Social Security Administration. Rules 26 to 37 don't apply in spirit. They just don't apply. They're for a different proceeding.
Right, but the submission of evidence, which was provided to establish the essential claim, the key issue in the government's charging document, which is that Ms. Young attempted to enter the United States on August 5, 1974, even though those particular discovery rules or evidentiary rules were not strictly applicable, still raises significant concerns about the sufficiency of this process. In keeping with prior decisions by this court of situations where an individual has not been afforded a meaningful opportunity to be heard, a meaningful opportunity to examine the evidence that's been presented against them, especially in a situation like this where certain key pieces of evidence were simply inconsistent with the narrative that the government attempted to create. The government's position was that Ms. Young attempted to enter the United States on August 5, 1974. In fact, there were certain documents they submitted which cited a date of entry in 1973. They submitted a passport at the final hearing, which was British Honduran. Ms. Young was a citizen of Belize, so it's simply unclear how this passport could have related to her. None of the documents that the government submitted throughout these immigration court proceedings included fingerprints from Ms. Young. They did not contain specific identification information. It was brought out during her testimony at this final hearing that she had had a passport stolen from her at some point. The immigration judge simply chose to ignore her testimony and made a hasty decision to find that Ms. Young had attempted to enter the United States on August 5, 1974, in spite of these key questions about the sufficiency of the evidence. I go back to the first issue, which I'd like to bring to Your Honor's attention, which is the lack of authentication of this evidence. This court has previously held that there is a certain degree of credibility that is accorded to immigration court records. Nevertheless, it is quite clear that this degree of deference is not open-ended, and that where there are key questions about the sufficiency of the evidence, the court will in fact often require some additional indicia of authentication, whether that be in the form of an affidavit or some other demonstration that that documentation is in fact a true and accurate record. Given the fact that we're looking at records which are nearly 40 years old in this instance and contain numerous discrepancies, which we've pointed out in our brief, but for the sake of summarizing once again, include inconsistent dates, which were characterized as typos, but in light of the fact that they really go to the heart of the issue, whether Ms. Young attempted to enter the United States in 1974, they cannot be dismissed as mere typos. Ms. Young herself conceded that she did attempt to enter the United States in 1973, but she also stated that she did not claim to be a United States citizen in doing so. Clearly, there are some concerns, numerous concerns, which should have warranted an opportunity for her to further examine this evidence. She might have been able to go back and examine whether or not there were, in fact, criminal records from the San Diego County Jail placing her there, which is what the government's position was. She might have been able to go back and discover any records showing that she, plane records, because the government's narrative was that she was, in fact, placed on a flight back from San Diego to head back to Guatemala, or Los Angeles, I should say.
What prevented her from doing any of these things?
Well, the fact that she didn't have notice of some of these documents until the final hearing is what prevented her, Judge.
Back to the discovery request. If somebody wants discovery, somebody has to ask, unless there is a particular rule saying documents of categories X, Y, and Z must be disclosed spontaneously, and you haven't contended that there is such a rule.
Well, there's an absence of such a rule in this context, Judge, and in the absence
of
such...
You need to ask.
Well, in the absence of such a rule, Judge, we would ask this court to decide whether these proceedings were in fact fundamentally fair. And they clearly were not.
When the United States was created, there was no such thing as pretrial discovery. Pretrial discovery is largely an invention of the mid-20th century. The norm was that all evidence was presented at trial and not before trial. It would be, let's just say anachronistic to say that the Due Process Clause, which was adopted in 1791, requires spontaneous pretrial discovery. It would mean that every legal proceeding held in the United States between its foundation and 1938 was unconstitutional.
Judge, I see that I'm out of time. Would you like me to respond? Or,
yes. Isn't that a problem for you?
Well, the analogy that I would draw here, Judge, would be to a criminal proceeding where an individual is given notice of certain documents, and then when they testify in court are ambushed with certain additional documents of which they had no prior notice. That's essentially what happened here.
There's no notice of documents in criminal cases outside of the discovery provided by Rule 16, which has to be requested. I have the same observation. There used to be no discovery at all in criminal cases. So you're saying that every criminal trial held in the United States until the 1960s, or maybe it was the 1970s, was unconstitutional.
That's not my position, Judge, and the analogy was drawn in spirit. Perhaps it wasn't the best analogy. It really, again, boils down to fundamental fairness, because as your honors know through previous consideration of numerous cases, there simply are no rules governing specifically the discovery process in immigration court proceedings. And so it is a judgment to be made of whether an alien has been afforded a meaningful opportunity to be heard, whether the evidence demonstrating that the individual is deportable and inadmissible is in fact reasonable, substantial, and probative.
By the way, do you have any response to the holding of Portillo Rendon that there's no liberty or property interest in the kind of relief you're seeking, so the Due Process Clause just has no application at all?
I certainly do have a
response. Statutes and regulations.
I certainly do have a response, Judge, because we are not advancing an argument based on her due process interest in adjustment of status. We are arguing an argument based on her interest in the actual procedural rights that she has in these.
You realize the Supreme Court in 1986 held that argument in particular was sanctionably frivolous. The case is Olam against Joaquin Acona. There is never, ever a due process interest in the procedures.
Well, we're not advancing a constitutional argument here, Judge. As this Court has recognized, we go back to the statutes and the regulations. And the statute, of course, the Immigration Nationality Act and the Code of Federal Regulations. And
but you already told me that no concrete statute or regulation was violated.
And that therein lies the responsibility of the Court to determine whether these proceedings were fundamentally fair. And it is
That's a due process argument, and when there's no liberty or property interest, there is no constitutional claim. I think we see your position, Mr. Shaw.
Thank you.
Ms. Monaco.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Carrie Monaco, and I represent the respondent, Attorney General Eric Holder, in this matter. The only issue in this petition for review is whether the petitioner was accorded the necessary process when the agency determined that she was ineligible for adjustment of status because she had falsely claimed to be a United States citizen when seeking entry in 1974. It appears my opposing counsel has conceded that the petitioner does not have a constitutional due process right in the proceedings because of a lack of liberty or property interest in the discretionary relief, but
he didn't exactly leap on it, if that's what you're...
Pardon?
I say your opponent didn't exactly leap on that argument. It was forced upon him, I suggest.
Well, in his reply brief, he appeared to concede that there is no liberty or property interest in adjustment of status. But
the Supreme Court did that for him.
Correct. But he does argue that his client has a process right based in the Immigration and Nationality Act.
Fundamental fairness is what he's arguing. He has right to be treated fundamentally fair.
Correct. And Ms. Young was treated fundamentally fair.
I don't suppose you concede that he was treated fundamentally unfairly.
I'm sorry. I didn't.
I don't suppose you concede that he was treated fundamentally unfairly.
No, she was. She was not. The Immigration and Nationality Act and the regulations provide for certain procedural requirements in immigration cases, Section 8 U.S.C. 1229A, which is...
Criminal prosecutors often avoid disputes like this by just saying, here's our file, come and look at it. Even Rule 16 may not require it to be disclosed, just come and look at it. Wouldn't it be sensible for the immigration agency to do the same thing? Here are the documents we're going to rely on, come look at them, and no beefing and groaning or last-minute motions for delay.
The major documents upon which the government relied in this case are Exhibits 4 through 6, which contain an immigration form I-213, along with a prosecution report and an incident report created by the Immigration and Nationality Service in 1974, contemporaneous with the event when Ms. Young sought entry to the U.S. Those documents, Exhibit 4 through 6, were submitted to the immigration court and served upon Ms. Young's counsel 3 weeks after the notice to appear was issued in this case, 3 weeks after she was placed into removal proceedings. Those documents were in Ms. Young's possession for 2 years prior to the merits hearing.
Okay, what about Exhibits 10 through 13? Why not disclose those before?
Those were submitted as rebuttal evidence based on her testimony at the trial for the first time where she had claimed that someone else may have used her passport.
It's still not addressing my question, which is, why doesn't the agency just say, look, here are the documents we've assembled. There they are. Take a look at them. Often the consequence will be the defendant gives up. It stipulates to removal, and if not, it would avoid this dispute. I understand the argument that you have a legal right to proceed as the agency did. My question was just a prudential question.
Typically, in immigration proceedings, that is the case. Typically, the immigration judge, or often the immigration judge, will set a deadline for both parties to submit evidence a certain number of days before the merits hearing to give the court an opportunity to review the evidence and give both parties to review the evidence. Some of those documents were submitted in advance, well in advance of the merits hearing in this case. I don't know why the other documents were not submitted earlier. It appears they were submitted as rebuttal evidence, but I have no knowledge of when.
That's the answer to Judge Easterbrook's question. You don't know.
I don't know. I don't know why they weren't submitted earlier.
Is it a policy? Do you know whether it's a policy of the government to hold back the documents and not show them?
I don't believe it's a policy, no. In this case, it was initially because the removal charge was based on the false citizenship claim for removal purposes, at least initially during the case, the burden was on the government. So it was their responsibility to submit those documents, and that's why they submitted Exhibits 4 through 6.
So this case, in your opinion, would be an aberration. Usually the government is forthcoming and says, this is what we've got.
Typically, I would think so, but I can't speak on behalf of every DHS attorney and their policies within DHS, a sister agency of ours. The bottom line is our position here is that Ms. Young was provided with an opportunity to review the evidence. She was on notice from the time that she was placed in removal proceedings, what evidence was being submitted by the government, with the exception of Exhibits 10 through 13, which really didn't enhance a whole lot in terms of evidence that she had falsely claimed citizenship in 1974. The main documents that prove the false citizenship were Exhibits 4 through 6 that were submitted earlier. Ms. Young had an opportunity prior to the merits hearing and at the merits hearing to submit counter evidence. She did not do so. She claimed that she had witnesses who could testify on her behalf to prove that she did not falsely claim citizenship in 1974. She never produced those witnesses, despite knowing that the false citizenship claim would be an issue at the merits hearing. She also never submitted affidavits from any of these witnesses as evidence of what she would have provided had process been accorded in the manner that she claims it should have been. And the other, in terms of the reliability of the documents...
When you say never, do you mean before the ALJ or also before the Board of Immigration Appeals?
Both, or this court.
Because one could imagine something in the nature of an offer of proof being made to the board, saying if the immigration judge had let me, I would have shown X.
Exactly, and she did not do that in this case. And then the, as my opposing counsel conceded, this court has already found that the that INS or DHS documents are typically considered reliable unless there's some reason to think they're not. When you look at the documents as a whole in this case, they're very consistent with each other. They were created contemporaneously with the event, and there's no reason to think that they were inaccurate in this case. And so for these reasons, it's our position that she was provided with the process required by the statute and the regulations, and her proceedings were fundamentally fair. And unless the court has any further questions for me, I will rest. Thank you.
Seems not. Thank you very much to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.